Welcome to the fifth lecture in this series on risk. So far we've been considering risk very much in the contemporary world, something that's quantified and managed and preferably avoided. But in earlier worlds, what happened then, long before we had the blessings of risk audits and risk assessments and all those things, how was risk viewed in past societies? Well, to discuss the title is Risk and Humanities, we're delighted to have an internationally distinguished scholar who actually works just across the road or just across the car park, depending on where she is, from this lecture hall. Professor Mary Beard's Professor of Classics here at Cambridge. She studied here and went to lecture at King's College London before coming back here in 1984. She's the classics editor of the Times Literary Supplement. She's written widely on both Greek and Latin subjects, and her most recently, splendidly readable book, Pompeii, The Life of a Roman Town, won the very distinguished Wolfson Prize. But Professor Beard is also known as a commentator on current events through the perspectives of the classical world. And almost as impressive, she has acquired a huge audience through her blog site, A Woman for All Seasons. It's a pleasure to introduce Mary Beard.
Thank you very much, Martha. I must say, I've followed this series of lectures and coming increasingly to the conclusion that I'm a real risk simpleton. You know, when these guys get up and they have these headlines which says, you know, green tea will cure cancer, we can't believe that, can we? And I'm the kind of person that, you know, goes out and buys green tea when they see that kind of headline. So I thought that I'm either the best person to be doing this lecture now, or completely the worst. We'll have to see. Anyway, we get a start in the Roman world. And this scene on the screen is, I think, the emblem for the lecture. What it shows is two Roman guys playing some sort of game of chance. They've got a board between them, and if you could get closer, you'd see it's got counters on them. And the man on the left has just been shaking the dice in a dice shaker, and in a little speech bubble, just there above his head, he's saying, "I've won." This guy, another speech bubble, says, "No, it's not a three, it's a two." Now, this is one of a series of paintings from the walls of a quite upmarket bar in Pompeii, and it was painted sometime in the last 10 years of the city's life, before the eruption of Vesuvius in 79. And it shows the kind of activities you'd expect to find going on in a bar, gaming and gambling amongst them. The kind of activities that old-fashioned Roman Puritans, who saw a very obvious connection between alcohol, sex, and dice games, were very keen on deploring. The scene we're looking at is, I think, both familiar to us and quite deeply unfamiliar, which is why I've chosen it as the kind of emblem for this evening. It's familiar to us because we too are used to making that association between sex, violence, seedy drinking dens, and the throw of the dice. In fact, it will come as no surprise to learn that in the next painting, the game is actually turning to blows. Now, the panel here is very badly damaged, but you can see that the two blokes are having a go at each other, and they are trading insults in the speech bubbles above. The insults are pretty incomprehensible, and when they're not incomprehensible, they're absolutely filthy. And I couldn't possibly repeat them now, but we'll tell anybody who asks me afterwards what they say. But meanwhile, almost completely lost, is the figure of the long-suffering landlord on the right, or alternatively the hard-nosed supremo of the drinking and gambling den, I suppose. And his speech bubble says, if you want to go fight, boys, get outside. But if we think a bit harder, if we scratch the surface of that scene, metaphorically in any way, we find a much less familiar world here of danger, chance, uncertainty, and what we, but not they, would call risk. And it's the principles of that world that I want to explore tonight. No gamblers in ancient Rome, remember, whatever their rough and ready common sense, would ever have formally conceptualized what is to us a very simple idea, that a six-sided dice had an equal 1 in 6 chance of landing on each of its 6 sides. In fact, you might say, in parenthesis, the fact that some Roman dice are so badly made, it might have meant they didn't actually have an equal chance, but some of them were good. And of course, and this kind of, I think, sits over you whenever you visit the Vesuvian sites, when this pair left the bar and they saw their local friendly mountain puffing out smoke from its crater, they certainly would not have engaged in our kind of calculations of disaster planning. They might not even have sniffed any danger at all. The best we can hope for these guys, if they were alive and if they were real, is that when the eruption really did come, they got out quick. So what I'm going to be doing in this lecture is looking at how the men and women in the ancient world, and I have to say it's mostly the men, saw, represented and understood the uncertainties and the dangers of their lives. I'm also going to be trying to ask a little about what it was they were anxious and uncertain about. Kind of, I have in my mind a sort of trying to see if you could map, a map of Roman worries I'm going to be thinking about. Because we certainly shouldn't assume that the same kind of things that worry us worried them. And I'm going to be concentrating on the world of the Roman Empire from roughly the 1st to the 4th centuries AD. And as far as I can, I'm going to be concentrating on the ordinary people, certainly not the world of elite philosophers. Certainly, elite philosophers did puzzle a lot about fate and chance and divine providence, but they aren't my subject, and there's people in the room who know a lot more about them than me. I'm not going to be concentrating on the likes of Plato and Aristotle. I'm trying to see if we can get back to the ancient man or woman, and it's largely man, in the street, and see what their feelings about danger were. Now, this is mainly then, most of what I'm going to be talking about is historical. But it's not only historical. I'm also going to wonder if this ancient model of danger that I'm going to be talking about can still actually say anything to us. When, for example, we reflect on how best to understand risk, say in the world of higher education, or the dangers or uncertainties of research and teaching in the humanities, could it be the case that the ancient model that I'm going to be delineating is actually rather more useful to us than the current risk agenda under which we are now asked to operate? That's the kind of kite I should be flying at the end of the lecture. Anyway, and it's partly in response to many of my colleagues who, when I said, you know, in conversation that I was going to go and give this lecture on risk and the humanities, they came back almost to a man and a woman with the instant quip along the lines of, oh, risk of not having a job, eh? Right? Now, I want to try and be a bit more sophisticated than that rather gloomy perspective. And I shall be coming back to that at the end. But let's start by looking a bit more carefully at some of the real central key differences between ancient understanding and, if you like, management of hazard and danger and modern ideas of risk. Now, of course, one of the things that those of you who followed these lectures will know is that modern definitions of risk themselves differ, and there are all kinds of debates and disagreements about how risk is to be managed or to be measured, even what it's to be called. Should we think of it as uncertainty? Is uncertainty a better word than risk? All the same, the simple fact that this series of Darwin lectures has taken risk as its theme is, I think, a nice illustration of how that idea comes to occupy center stage in academic, cultural, and media agendas. It's a nice, simply the fact that you can get an audience for a series of lectures on risk. Another nice illustration you have on the screen now. This is a simple schematic graph taken from Google News, plotting the number of uses of the word risk in all the news media from 1840 to 2010 that have been scanned by Uncle and Auntie Google. The takeoff from the 1990s is dramatic. And in case you think, because I'm sure some of you will, in case you think that what you've got here is a classicist being a complete statistical idiot, and that all this actually shows is that news media expanded tremendously in the 1990s, or that Google has concentrated on the later period, let me show you the pattern that you get if you do danger. Now, don't bother too much about the raw numbers in this. The total for danger gets hugely inflated because the same search, or at least the same search if it's done by me, I'm sure there's other ways of doing this, the same search picks up dangerous as well as danger and dangereux in French. So you in some ways inflate the number for this. What I want to highlight is the takeoff in news reporting on risk in our world from the late 80s, perhaps 1990s onwards, compared with the steady state and probably relative decline of reporting on danger. To put it another way, as I kind of said a few minutes ago, it would, I think, be inconceivable that when these lectures started, they would have chosen the subject risk for their theme, or they certainly wouldn't have chosen it if they wanted to get an audience. Turn this off for a minute. Now, schematic as that illustration was, it fits very nicely, in chronological terms, it fits very nicely with Anthony Giddens's definition of our own post-industrial society as what he would call a risk society. What characterizes risk society, for Giddens and for others, are a number of key factors that we easily recognize, I think, in ourselves, in our own behavior, in our world. For example, our belief that relative degrees of hazard can, in theory, be estimated and given an arithmetic value. Now, in practice, we disagree what that arithmetic value should be, and we also tend to disagree about how many of the risks we face can be given a numerical value. But still, we essentially think that there is something about risk which is measurable in many cases. We also believe very strongly that the state and we as individuals have a duty actively to manage risk and hazard, usually in popular parlance by avoiding it, right? We occasionally take calculated risks. That's quite an interesting word in itself, calculated risk, when we say go potholing or rock climbing. But basically, we think that risk is something to be avoided. Despite this, despite the sense of active management, we can also feel quite powerless in the face of risk. And this is something else that Giddens stresses. For in an increasingly global world, the causes of hazard seem to be very much in increasingly outside our control. Now, the classic case of that would be the disaster of Chernobyl, whose effects we could manage, you know, we could decide not to eat Welsh lamb or whatever, but whose causes were out of our power. It was something like so many modern hazards that sort of happened to us, that we were the passive victims of this risk. Now, I'm going to be suggesting at the end of this talk that universities have also come to see themselves as the passive victims of hazard and danger in a similar way. Now, the ultimate drivers behind modern risk society, why risk society and those assumptions developed when they did, are, as I'm sure you know, intensely debated. But everybody agrees that one necessary, not sufficient, but necessary condition for being able to approach risk in the modern sense is what the philosopher Ian Hacking has termed the emergence of probability, the development of the ability arithmetically to calculate chance. Now, in a wonderful scientific legend, which is just as untrue as it is true, that moment goes back to 1654, when Pascal brilliantly used probabilistic calculations to solve the problem, the key problem, of how to divide up the stake in an unfinished gambling game. It all comes back. The message of this lecture actually is everything comes back to the dice. Now, true legend or not, and it's probably not, the date is roughly correct. Probability theory and the cognitive revolution that it unleashed is a phenomenon of the 17th century and later. So how does this work for Rome? That is kind of our world in an oversimplified nutshell. How does it work for Rome? Well, Rome is quite different. And there you will find none of the key elements of our risk agenda. You can look for them and you won't find them. It's true, of course, how could it not be, that the word probability does itself derive from a Latin adjective probabilis, probabile. But in Latin, that usually means worthy of approval or commendable. When it is used, and it sometimes is, when it is used in a sense more like our own, I mean credible or likely, it is never associated with any precise form of calculation. The closest that you come to that in Rome, and frankly it isn't very close, is in a discussion by the first century orator and polymath Cicero. It's a discussion of playing the knuckle bones, which were an alternative form of dice made out of animal ankle bones with just four numbered sides. Cicero is talking about the so-called Venus throw. That's the prize result when you throw four knuckle bones on the floor and each one produces a different number. And he says that if you made 100 throws, you wouldn't get 100 Venus throws simply by chance, which does show some practical experience and observation of dicing. No, you don't. But it's a very long way from any calculation of probability. And so too, as I said, my dicers sitting in their bar at Pompeii arguing about whether it was a 3 or a 2 could not possibly have seen that argument in the terms of probability that we use. As for the idea, the other big idea that marks modern states, that is the idea of the responsibility that we all have for the management of risk, I need only tell you one story about a man called Ignatius Rufus, who during the reign of the first emperor Augustus, at the very end of the first century BC, used 60 of his own slaves to act as Rome's very first fire brigade. To us, that seems a classic instance of simple but sensible risk management, not to say a kind of Lord Shaftesbury-esque kind of version of social improvement. So you'll say, was Ignatius Rufus honoured and rewarded for this initiative? I'm afraid he wasn't. The answer is he was executed. His actions were treated as a means of currying favour with the rabble. It was a sign that he was aiming at power and so a threat to the emperor himself, and he was put to death. Now, he might indeed have been aiming at power, but it shows you, I think, instantly a completely different inverse view of how the state or the individual should manage risk. So how did the Romans then, if that's what they didn't have, how did they deal with uncertainty, and how can we understand the ways that they did? Well, despite what I've just said, one way recently has been, in a sense, to try, despite all these apparent absences, to try to discern some faint traces in the Roman evidence of what we might call a risk agenda, not wholly dissimilar to our own, even if much less explicit. There's been a series of attempts to recreate what you might call a kind of buried or embedded discourse of risk within apparently very different material in Roman culture. Now, I have to say, I've never found any of this remotely convincing, but I shall later on be looking at one attempt to use Greek and Roman oracles as if they were a semi, at least, rational system of risk management. And you will be able to see whether you believe it any more than I do. But for the most part, in the absence of anything that we can see as a calculation of the probability of danger, let alone a recognizable risk agenda or risk management strategy, we have tended to consign the poor old ordinary Greeks and Romans to a world of utterly unpredictable danger. We have tended to see them as seeing themselves as kind of buffeted by the capricious whim of fate, of chance, or of the gods, with little defense apart from keeping on the right side of the supernatural powers and crossing your fingers and hoping for the best, or shrugging your shoulders and thinking, just let it come because it's all preordained anyway. Now, part of that is no doubt not wholly wrong. And indeed, ancient philosophers do busy themselves frightfully about making fine distinctions between chance and fate and providence. But I want to argue that actually in this material I'm going to show you, there are clear signs of a much more positive engagement with ideas of uncertainty and danger than that rather gloomy and passive picture suggests. It's not, in other words, that the Romans were really just like us, but somehow they simply lacked our ability to calculate probability or to take sensible risk management activities seriously and therefore were deeply, deeply disadvantaged. The Romans, I want to say, are operating with an alternative model of what you do about uncertainty and danger. That's to say, if we live, as Giddens would have it, in a risk society, the ancients, I want to argue, were the inhabitants of an aleatory society. And it's going to be the sort of pseudo-technical slogan for how I see ancient culture. An aleatory society is a term that I'm adapting from one of my Oxford friends, Nicholas Purcell, who's done some quite important work on the nature of Roman dicing and gambling, for which, as you'll see, the Latin generic term was alea. So alea, aleatory society. And Purcell has pointed to, quite interestingly, what he sees as an analogy between success and failure with the dice in the ancient world and success and failure economically or more generally. Why Romans loved to gamble, in Purcell's sense, is because gambling was like their life anyway. Life was a lottery. Trade in particular, he argues, for the Romans, with all the hazards that it involved, was not much different from a game of dice. It depended on luck. You either won loads and got rich, or you lost. Now, I want to take that, but to push it rather further in a slightly different direction, and to argue that it was not, as Purcell suggests, that there was any particular aspect or aspects of Roman life which were like a game of dice. Because I think if you go in that direction, you tend to go back to the rather passive model of the Romans being buffeted by fate that I've just criticised. What I want to argue is that the Romans actively used the imagery of dicing to parade and then, in a sense, to manage uncertainty. They actively constructed other areas of hazard in their lives on the model of dicing, so that the luck of the board game became a way of seeing, classifying, and understanding what in our terms we talk of as risk. Now, this idea of really facing and parading the lot and the dice and the gamble was actually reinforced by a wider symbolic repertoire that really underlies what I'm going to say, but I won't have any time to do more than mention it this evening. But that includes the idea of the personification of luck and good fortune in both the Greek and the Roman worlds as divine figures. And just so you don't miss out, this is a small miniature bronze version of the most famous goddess of Lady Luck in the whole of the ancient world. There are literally thousands of these images of good luck. The Tyche, the goddess of good fortune, particularly associated with the prestige and success of the city of Antioch. So what I'm going to say is that the Romans are managing uncertainty on an aleatory model. Now, that is to say, quite a lot more than simply observing that gaming with dice or knuckle bones, for cash or not, was an actually absolutely central activity across all ranks of Roman society, though that is certainly the case. Roman moralists bang on all the time about what a dreadful thing gambling is. They talk about how it is or should be regulated. They talk about how it is or should be prohibited. It's supposed to have been banned, for example, except on certain holidays. There are all kinds of Roman laws which limit your right of redress if you lose money in gambling and so forth. They bang on about it all the time, about how dreadful it is, and yet gambling and the remains of gambling are everywhere you look throughout the Roman world. I think it's an interesting case, actually, where the classicists tended to get rather taken in by the Roman moral message. You know, often those things that are banged on about, whether in the ancient or the modern world, are those that are most prevalent within culture. And in some ways, the banging on about them makes them even more visible. You know, you legislate about something that really is in your mind. And you can see, I mean, we could spend hours just looking at the remains of Roman gambling. Thousands upon thousands of dice and knuckle bones are found. And there were once many more. I mean, archaeologists are terribly bad at recognizing knuckle bones because they're, after all, just knuckle bones. So you can't tell whether they're a knuckle bone that happens to have come off a dead sheep or whether they were a knuckle bone that was diced with. They recognize dice, but not always knuckle bones. So we've got them. We also get actual gaming boards surviving. This is a nice one from Nubia, and it's actually in wood, which is rather rare. Most often we find them scratched on stone. You can find them, for example, carved into the steps of the Forum at Rome. The recent excavation on a Roman military camp on the Red Sea produced no fewer than 20 gaming boards in one military camp. And the archaeologists, I think rather optimistically, thought they'd found the gambling den because a large number of them were found all together in a rather dark, small room. There are also clearly different forms of these boards, which must have been used for different sorts of games. And those games, I have to say, have occupied many, many hours of the highest level scholarly attention, but it has proved impossible satisfactorily to reconstruct the rules. You want to kind of get some idea of what students of ancient gambling do. And it seems to me it's rather like reconstructing the rules of Monopoly when all you've got is the board, some houses and hotels, and the get out of jail free card, and how you would start to think what the rules of Monopoly were on that basis, I don't know. You get some very mad reconstructions. But one of the most instantly recognisable boards is the type that you've got here, and it seems to belong to an ancient version of sort of backgammon played with dice and counters known as 12-point. And it has either two, or as here, three rows of either six squares. Sometimes there's the squares, you get six on this side, six on that side, so you get 12 altogether. In three rows. Sometimes those squares, which are here nicely inlaid, are replaced by letters. And sometimes, interestingly, those letters are joined up so that actually the gambling board makes a sentence as well as being a gambling board. And often those sentences have a moral or ethical message, as you see here. So you can see how it goes. You've got reject profit, insane greed turns you mad, which is, of course, a great message for a gambling board. And there, somewhat more militaristically, Parthians are being killed, the Britons slaughtered, play on Romans, right? Interestingly, drawing an analogy, which I shall return to, between military activity and dicing. But what I suppose I'm saying is that it's very interesting to see how dicing and the paraphernalia of the dicing game actually subsumes Roman ethics within it, morality and ethics. And in the end, by the time you get to the 4th or 5th centuries AD, you'll find sort of second-rate philosophers actually turning out these sentences of six words, of six letters, precisely to make a moral point. So the dicing game and the conventions of dicing start to frame what ethics is. So you get all the stuff, you get what you people diced with, and thousands of representations of people playing dice. Here's another image from another bar in Pompeii. Here is a nice little street scene from a mosaic in Antioch. And you've got street scene, and the houses are named at the top. And you can probably just see that outside this house, what are the guys doing? They're sitting down and they're gaming. You find images like that on calendars. Here's a version of the month of December from a late Roman calendar. And predictably enough, because it's the ceremony of the Saturnalia, where everybody has a good old gamble, here is a dice shaker and two dice on the table beside December. You find them on cheap pottery lamps, and of course you find them on tombstones. Standing, these images of dicing and gaming, standing, I think, not only for life's pleasures, but also for life and death's lottery. There are even literary descriptions of tombstones that just have dice on them. All they've got on the tombstone is dice. Now, I can't resist showing... This one. Now, I have to say, this is a very, very sad object, but I did want to say that even in the depths of Roman Britain, you find some version of gaming and gambling coming up just the same way on Roman memorials. Now, this is a very, very seedy tombstone from Brough in Humber, but it's now in the Fitzwilliam Museum, which is why I put it on. And actually, you probably won't be able to see, but there's some funny crosses here on the top of it, which mimic exactly the form of one particular sort of gaming board. So it looks like just nasty sort of Romano-British scratching. But this probably too is also showing you a gaming board. Let's get rid of that. But as I was suggesting, the cultural importance of dicing in Rome runs even deeper than that. And it provides a way of really, I think, modelling the hazards of trade, politics, and war. Even it provides a model for constructing national identity. When the Roman historian Tacitus is writing his ethnography of the Germans, one thing he insists on is that they dice differently from the Romans. But think for a moment of politics. Most of you, I'm sure, are already familiar with what Julius Caesar is supposed to have said when he declared war on his political enemies at Rome and marched into Italy with his army across the boundary of the river called the River Rubicon. He's supposed to have said, "Alea iacta est," the die is cast. It's become one of the most famous Latin quotes ever, even though I have to tell you, Caesar probably said it in Greek, but, you know, the Latin one. Now, in our own cultural repertoire, it's become a slogan for the point of no return. It's as if Caesar was saying, civil war is now inevitable, there's no going back. That's how we use the phrase, the die is cast. And that indeed may have been part of it when Caesar was invading. But I don't think in ancient terms it's actually what Caesar primarily had in mind. By choosing the metaphor of the dice, Caesar was parading the uncertainty, the hazard, the danger of the political and military outcomes of what he was about to embark on. He was not saying everything's fated and it's inevitable. He's saying this is jolly dangerous and we don't know what's going to happen. He was right. And actually, as I hinted a bit ago, if you're looking for another link between this kind of military activity and games of chance, one nice way of finding it is in the shapes given to dice shakers, which very often are done in the shape of military towers from military forts. So in a sense, you're seeing the outcome of war as, in my sense, aleatory. It's no surprise, then, perhaps, that dicing and gaming was an important element in the image of the emperors who followed Julius Caesar. Old Claudius of Vi Claudius fame was said to be an absolute gambling obsessive. He even wrote a book about dicing, which sadly doesn't survive. If it did survive, we'd know the rules, I imagine. And in a nasty, very nasty Roman satire written shortly after the death of old Claudius, he was envisaged languishing in the underworld, one of his punishments there being to have to shake a dice in a dice box which didn't have a bottom to it. For eternity, right? He does get rescued, actually. But dicing was also the Roman emperor's power in controlling even the games of chance was mediated and discussed. In general, though, as this powerful and repeated insistence, almost everywhere you look, in the Roman world, this repeated insistence on dicing and its symbolism illustrates. Rome was a culture that crucially looked danger in the eye. It did not attempt to avert or calculate danger, but rather, in a sense, to assert and celebrate the uncertainties, chances, and dangers of human existence. And that's what I meant by referring to it as an aleatory society. And it's a very, very different way of imaging danger from our own, but it's not simply the passivity we sometimes assume the Romans were locked into. Romans were not simply the dupes of the playthings of fate. They managed danger by repeatedly reminding themselves that they were always facing it head on. It's looking danger in the eye. It's a standoff. But there's more to it even than that. For in fact, the throw of the dice could be used not only to expose uncertainty, but also to resolve it. I'm thinking here of what is known as dice oracles, a system whereby The numbers which came up on the throw of the dice or knuckle bones represented, if you decoded them, an answer to a question that was troubling the person who threw the dice. Now, what you need to remember here is that most ancient oracles are not like we imagine them. Our standard image of an ancient oracle comes almost entirely from the Delphic Oracle and a few others like it. And here we find ancient kings and statesmen coming to consult the god Apollo, and so the stories go, leaving with a riddling or ambiguous reply. In other words, the stock in trade of the oracular god here was to meet uncertainty with an almost equal uncertain response. So the most famous example, I guess, is King Croesus of Lydia going to Delphi in the 6th century BC to find out if he should go to war with King Cyrus of Persia. The oracle said that if he did, he would destroy a great empire. Encouraged, he went to war, and you can see what the answer is. He did end up destroying a great empire. The trouble was, it was his own great empire that he destroyed. The Delphic oracle had rather carefully hedged its bets, I think. Okay, that's the popular image. The fact is, most oracles in the ancient world, and by oracles I'm using that term to refer to, you know, anything right down to street fortune tellers, the vast majority of oracles gave people who consulted them a pretty clear steer about what they should do, even if not absolutely straight answers. Some of those answers were, like Delphi, authenticated by the voice of the god, but I don't think we need to go a bundle on how many gods there were involved in all this. There was also magic, arcane foreign law, and simply the aleatory power of the dice having a role. And dice oracles are an interesting case. They're a widespread phenomenon right through the Mediterranean, but they appear in a most strikingly monumental form in some Roman cities in what's now Turkey. You go to a group of these cities, you'll find a large stone pillar has been erected, let's say in the marketplace, and on this pillar have been inscribed lists of all the possible 56 throws that you can get with 5 knuckle bones and a response to match. Consultation could not have been easier. You go along, you throw your knuckle bones, you look at the numbers, and the answer is on the pillar. Have a look at this one. This is a good one. Happiness. You've got a 6, 6, 4, 4, 3, 3, coming up to 23. If 2 sixes... whoops, I put an extra 3 in. Oh dear, I'm not going to get a good, happy answer. Take off a 3. If 2 sixes are cast and 2 fours and the 5th is a 3, sail wherever you want. You will return home again, having found and done everything according to your wish. You will achieve everything, and thus to buy and trade is happiness. But they weren't all so upbeat. On the gloomier side, a throw of 1, 6, 4, 4, 3 warned, "You show no insight at all if you sell now, nor will it be useful," and so on. Now, these inscribed responses are interesting in all kinds of ways. They're interesting about how you think you get the answer from the dice and so forth. But they're also interesting, of course, because they give us, and this is what I was heralding at the beginning, they give us some access to what these men in the marketplace who used these oracles 2,000 years ago felt anxious or uncertain about. And it's this that I want to turn to now. For talking about the parade of uncertainty and hazard, I think, is one thing, and it's important. But we also want to know what kind of issues prompted anxiety in the ancient world. Because not every culture, as I said, worries about the same things. And as we've seen repeatedly in this series of lectures, people often worry about things that are not their realist danger. You know, we're much more worried about air travel than car travel. And Mary Douglas has that famous example about the Lele in Zaire, who are prey to most appalling tropical diseases, but spend their time worrying that they're going to be struck by lightning. And at least Mary Douglas sees that they weren't stupid to worry about that. Now, it turns out, I have to say, a bit sadly, that the dice oracles are not hugely revealing in this respect. Or rather, Better, they appear to be serving a rather specific niche market of anxiety in the ancient world. For the majority of the responses on these great pillars that you find in these Turkish towns, the majority of responses seem to reflect anxiety about one area of life only, which is ancient business ventures and trade. Not exclusively so, there are a few responses that refer to illness and to death, but it's mainly economic life that they're talking about. And in a way, of course, that fits with the position of these oracular pillars. They're slap bang in the middle of the commercial area of these little towns. They're there ready for the local business merchants to consult, and they're simultaneously, in my terms, parading the uncertainties and chance of ancient commerce and also offering some sort of resolution to those uncertainties. A much more vivid glimpse of more varied concerns, however, is provided by a different set, even more intriguing set of oracular texts, several copies of which are preserved on papyrus, not stone in this case. Now, in the introduction on the papyrus to these texts, these books of oracles are said to have been handed down from the mathematician Pythagoras through the Egyptian magician Astrampsychus, hence their title, The Oracles of Astrampsychus. They're even said to have been the favourite oracular device of Alexander the Great. They claim to be Alexander the Great's secret decision-making weapon in conquering the world. He took the oracles of Astrampsychus with him, and they told him what to do. Now, in fact, all that is a mad, spurious, exoticizing advert for the book, which certainly wasn't around in the age of Alexander the Great. It's probably a 2nd century AD commercial handbook for fortune tellers. Now, the system here is a bit more complicated, oracle, and it doesn't appear to be a do-it-yourself method like the dice oracle was. And there's a good deal of obfuscation built in to getting an answer out of it, presumably to protect the mystery and therefore the profit of the fortune teller. So what I'm going to do now is to show you, first of all, what a consultation would look like from the outside, and then I'm going to show you how it was done. No dice are involved, and as you'd be pleased to know for the first time, but we do need an assistant. So we're going to have Dr. Scott is going to come up, and I have to say that this, I should, just to boast, this is the first public consultation of the oracles of Astrampsychus for several centuries. And you'll see we've already got our oracular book, which we prepared earlier, on the table. And Dr. Scott, you have to imagine, is a worried Roman. And he needs an answer to his uncertainties. He has come to consult me, the fortune teller, and I point him to a list of problems in my little book. It should be a scroll, but we couldn't manage a scroll, I'm afraid. And I tell him that he's got to choose from the list of problems in there the problem that most closely matches his own. Now, in real life, presumably this was accompanied by a considerable amount of very lengthy mumbo jumbo, but we're going to kind of cut this to the essentials. So I say to him, okay, young man, which is your problem?
Can I have question 100, Mary, please?
You can. Right, now, a bit more mumbo jumbo. And then I say, as magicians have said forever, since time immemorial, think of a number between 1 and 10.
Help? 1.
More mumbo jumbo. Okay, more mumbo jumbo. And I say, right, I've got to get the book, I think. It's got the answers in the back. I say, tell me your number again, young man.
1.
Lots of scroll unfurling is now going on. And I finally beam, and I say, I've got good news for you, young man. And this is now where you discover what his question was. The oracle says, no, you will not get caught in adultery.
Phew.
And off he goes, beaming and happy. Now, Dr. Scott had asked me to make absolutely clear that this was an entirely fictional consultation, and that any resemblance to people living or dead is completely fortuitous, except John Terry, we thought, actually. The consultation, however, might not have turned out so well. If he'd chosen six, the oracle's answer would have been, "You won't be caught as an adulterer for some time yet." Two would have produced, "Yes, you'll be caught in adultery soon." And seven would have brought a nasty surprise. "You're not an adulterer, but your wife's in love with somebody else." Okay, so how is it done? Well, as we saw, the consultation starts from a list of 92 numbered questions, running confusingly from number 12 to number 103. Don't ask me why. Will I get caught in adultery? Will I inherit? And I'll come back to the questions in a bit. Anyway, our inquirer chooses number 100 from the list. Oops. And you can see that's just the section that was around where he picked his question from. Will I get caught in adultery soon? He then thinks of his number between 1 and 10, and the fortune teller adds that number to the number of the question. So in Michael's case, he'd picked question 100, he chose number 1, that equaled 101. Fortune teller then goes to another list, or a so-called table of correspondences, which converts that total, 101, into a different number again, 32. But we still haven't got the answer, because that new number directs you to one of a whole series of numbered groups of 10 answers, or decades, and within the decade, the number he first thought of, in Michael's case, 1, identifies the answer that applies to him. Number 32, decade 1, you won't be caught in adultery. Right. It's quite simple, but if it seems a bit baffling, that's the point. Right. For our concerns this evening, though, there are two important features of this. First, each question has got 10 possible answers. Right. I won't explain to you exactly why that must be, but I can tell you there are 10 possible answers for each question. And this takes us straight back to issues of the calculation of probability, or the absence of the calculation of probability in antiquity that I discussed briefly at the start of this lecture. Now, in a book published last year, the Cambridge classicist Jerry Toner thought he could discern some pretty accurate probabilistic, or perhaps better, actuarial statistics buried in this rubbish. He looked, for example, at the 10 possible answers to the question, "Will I rear the baby?" 3 answers suggested that the baby would survive. 3 suggested that it would survive with difficulty. 2 suggested that it would die. And 1 that it would not be reared, which is the ancient euphemism for being killed. Oh, and 1 that it would thrive. Yes, the next to one. Now, Toner pointed out that division of outcomes for this baby was actually not far from what we know of the demographic probabilities of an infant's survival in the Roman world, in which it's estimated, just as the oracle has it, that 3 out of 10 wouldn't make it through the first year. And he went so far on the basis of this to suggest that the popularity of this oracular system was precisely because it reflected what we would call the real risks of the situation. Now, if that were true, it would be extremely significant and would undermine quite a lot of what we think we know about the modern history of probability. But it probably isn't true. And it's no coincidence, I think, here that Toner's a very interesting classicist because he also has a career as a financier. And I think that it's very interesting, this is attempting to bring the risk of finance into the risk of oracles. But it's certainly true that some distributions of answers do produce a pretty realistic probability, but even more of them don't. Take, for example, the question, am I being poisoned? Where 4 out of 10 answers say yes. Now, you might argue, I suppose, that anyone asking whether they'd been poisoned had a greater than average chance to be an at-risk group of poisoning than others. But even so, 4 out of 10 seems pretty high. More interesting, though, as Turner himself would, I think, agree, more interesting is the range of uncertainties that these 92 questions reveal, where we see both an overlap with our own anxieties and a world of worry that is significantly different from our own. Similar are a whole array of questions about marriage, love affairs, sex, illness, commercial and career success. Is my wife having a baby? That's a question, incidentally, which gets a 10 out of 10 yes response, which I think pretty well puts paid to the actuarial line or suggests an extraordinary degree of fecundity amongst the questioners. Will I get the girl I want? 7 yeses, 3 noes. At least one of the yeses says, when you've got her, you'll decide you don't want her. And one later Christian version of the text has, will I become a bishop? Which has got a 5 out of 5, 5 versus 5. Again, suggesting an upmarket group of consultants. More striking, though, are the range of worries that don't match our own. I've already mentioned, have I been poisoned? It's also clear there must have been slaves among the questioners, because will I be sold is one question, which gives a nice little glimpse into the uncertainties of slave life. But for me, the real surprise is the range of questions that refer to Roman law. Am I safe from prosecution? Will I be informed against? Will I argue my case? Now, we, both scholars and elite Romans, are used to thinking of the Roman legal system as a great safeguard against danger, a protection for the citizen. In our terms, I suppose Roman law is a risk management device. That's not how it appears in the oracles of Astrampsychus, where it is a menace, a threat, and its processes themselves are what is feared. It's a pattern of assumptions, I think, that fits with something that I'd never noticed before until I came to work on this lecture, that some of the technical vocabulary of Roman law actually overlaps with the technical vocabulary of gambling. So, for example, the Latin word for the deposit you put down at the start of a case is the same as a word for a bet, sponsio. So to put it another way, we're back here with that story of Ignatius Rufus and his fire brigade, and to a Roman world where, in some respects at least, what we think of as the mechanisms of risk aversion are seen as dangers themselves. So to finish, does this world of the Romans, does it have anything to say to us? Does it speak to us? Does it speak to us when we think of our lives within the university? And more precisely, given the title of my talk, does it speak to us when we think of risk in the humanities? I want finally to suggest in a slightly devious way that it does. And this gets personal, but I think I'm speaking to things that many of you will relate to. Anyone who's worked in our university system for the last, I wrote 20 years to start with, and I realised it was 30 years. Anyone who's worked in the university system for so long can hardly have failed to notice how the risk agenda has encroached on an awful lot of what we do. If someone had told me when I started teaching 30 years ago that I would end up filling out a risk assessment form in order to take a group of 10 young adult students on a sedate trip to the British Museum, I would have thought they were joking. But this is what I do now with only the very slightest degree of irritation. I get more irritated when I find they're going clubbing all night and they don't have to do a risk assessment form for going clubbing. But some of what we do is more than irritating. And it's hard, I think, not to be worried by what we might call the Chernobyl effect in higher education's attitude to risk. The idea somehow that risk comes upon you and you are free of responsibility for that risk. In preparing for this evening, I spent some truly horrible hours going through online risk assessments of, for the most part, American universities. Among the risks you regularly find on their list is quality of academic staff, which is, for a start, laughable, but implies a truly irresponsible view of university teachers and researchers on the part of the administration, as if they were a risk to be managed, not a group of people to be cherished, supported, and enhanced. And if it was as if it was not the duty of the university actively to ensure the high quality of its staff. We see much the same thing, and I have to say I'm afraid closer to home, in our own changing ideas and obsession with student plagiarism, which is also increasingly seen not as cheating, for which I am responsible, but an appalling academic catastrophic ill that might happen to me. Now, if you want a nasty read, go to the General Board's guidelines on plagiarism, but I'm not going to quote them. An even worse illustration of how we think about plagiarism is the University of East Anglia's anti-plagiarism quiz entitled, Are You at Risk of Plagiarism? Now, I have to say naively, when I came across this, I thought this means, am I at risk of being plagiarized? You know, how would I know if somebody had copied me? But actually, what it means is, are you at risk of plagiarizing? There are 13 questions aimed to get across such key facts as plagiarism can happen accidentally, and you might not always know you've done it. And that fear of plagiarism should not mean that you don't talk to your friends about your work. It all makes plagiarism seem like a nasty illness that you might have contracted without knowing it, but one that shouldn't prevent normal human contact. But, you know, it's about to say, don't share a toothbrush, you know. In fact, as one of my colleagues pointed out to me, plagiarism actually sounds like an illness, if you say it, whereas cheating doesn't. But finally, absolutely finally, and closest to my heart, is the increasingly risk-averse agenda that we find in humanities research, whether at doctoral level or in senior research projects. Now, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, in a completely different academic world, potential PhD students applied for what were then British Academy grants simply by writing down their study as Roman history or English. Now our students have to write a whole essay summarising their conclusions before they have done the work. Now, the old system might have seemed cavalier, but I wonder if we got worse results from it. And any more senior scholar in the room who's ever applied for AHRC research money will know all too well that you now have to specify exactly what the outcomes will be and even the timetable week by week towards achieving them. The AHRC has become so risk-averse, frankly, that the only safe and sensible way to get money out of them is to apply for funding that work that you've already done. Then you know you'll have an outcome. Now, we've all come to think of these mechanisms as prudence, perhaps slightly irritating, but the responsible management of public money. And we seem to have forgotten that this is not how research in the humanities is carried out, certainly not how good research is carried out. The basic point is you don't know what you are going to find when you open a book, and you can't, parte this desire for a timetable, you can't say how long it will take you to read it. It depends on how interesting you make it for yourself. And an awful lot of the best work depends on a very great deal of luck. Indeed, I think what distinguishes successful humanities researchers from less successful ones is, in a part, the fact they're luckier. It's not that they've managed the risks better. So you now see where the Romans come in. I suppose I want to say that libraries are very dangerous places. You find the entirely unexpected there. You never know what you're going to find when you go in. And you get prompted to think all kinds of things that gets you bad publicity or Nobel Prizes or whatever. And I think it seems to be important that we should accept that fact about humanities research, and we should parade and face the danger. Research in humanities, I want to argue, is part of a Roman aleatory culture. It is not properly seen as part of a risk-managed culture. And it is simply dishonest to pretend that it can be risk-managed. So my motto that, oops, I meant to remind you about these guys before. My motto for closing this lecture is alia iacta est, because I think that is what we should inscribe on the AHRC's coat of arms. Thank you.
Well, to begin at the ending, as another academic, I firmly uphold the view that if research isn't risky, it isn't worth doing. But this is clearly a diminishing view of the world. I'm sure that all those who've acted as health and safety officers for buildings will approve of Ignatius Rufus as our patron, how to become extremely unpopular by doing good. And I did notice while Michael was doing the consultation with the Oracle, a number of my colleagues taking notes in economics and in law. So it may be that you've introduced a new aspect of our syllabus this evening. One of the things I found so fascinating about the five lectures we've had so far is how often a discussion of risk from whatever angle quite quickly comes round to notions of free will and agency and human control. And one of the things I think that Professor Beard has got across so clearly is in a way that the sense of people under extreme uncertainty to see events as random rather than probabilistic. And what a wonderful insight this beautiful, I think, lecture has given us into the way which people coped with the brutal realism of a much harsher world. Thank you very much indeed.